This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jamal Green is a professor of law at Columbia Law School, and he joins us on the program today. Professor Green, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I would like to start by asking you a series of questions that popped up in my mind as we read your new book, How Rights Went Wrong. So first of all, when Karen Finley claimed the right to National Endowment for the Arts funding for her performance art, which included smearing chocolate all over her body, did the court recognize her right?
No.
It did not. Okay. Now, there's also another more famous case that when a baker in Colorado claimed the right to refuse to make a cake for a same-sex wedding, how did the court rule on that case?
He won his case. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but he did win the case.
Yeah, that is a simplification of a case that took several years to wind its way to the Supreme Court. I acknowledge that. But there's another one. And when a man in Louisiana claimed the right to food, clothing, and shelter, did the court recognize those rights?
No, not at all.
Okay, so these are some of the cases that you do talk about in your new book, How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. So with these three sample cases here, what is it that you think binds them all together?
I think basically nothing binds them together. And that's part of the point is that I think in layperson's terms, when you look at the docket of the Supreme Court, and look at some of the rights conflicts that we see there. There's no particular connection to justice or intuitions or anything. I could name a dozen other cases where nothing about the equities of the case necessarily tells you how a court will come out, and so it ends up being a kind of arbitrary sort of game that lawyers play in trying to figure out who has rights and who doesn't.
Mm, okay. And yet these cases frequently end up in court. And the question of the acknowledgement or a violation or perceived acknowledgement or violation of an individual's rights is at the core of these cases. But, I mean, your whole book is about how you – I mean, the title is How Rights Went Wrong. And you talk about a rights fetishization or a rightism, as you call it in America. What do you mean by that?
What rights fetishization or rightsism refers to in the book is the tendency to think that disputes about rights are all about figuring out who has the right and who doesn't have the right. And when you figure out who has the right, that person is basically supposed to win. And the person who doesn't have the right is basically supposed to lose. And so the dispute is just about figuring out, you know, which side the Constitution prefers and which side the Constitution ignores or doesn't prefer. And we arrive at that place on the view that rights are supposed to be absolute or close to absolute. Maybe you can violate them in an emergency, but that they're basically supposed to be absolute. So someone has to win and someone has to lose, and that requires an assignment of rights to one side or the other. And that's destructive in any number of ways that I outline in the book, including divorcing rights talk from our intuitions about justice, because justice often lies somewhere in the middle between awarding rights entirely to one side and not to another.
Okay, divorcing rights talk from justice. We're going to come back to that. But in hearing you describe what essentially sounds like the American approach to rights has been reduced down to a zero-sum game, right? If these are adjudicated in court, I still struggle with trying to imagine a different approach, which we'll talk about in a second, because there's something that seems to be very core, very American about the focus on rights as not just absolute, but even existential. Has it always been this way, or are you arguing that this is something relatively new?
So I acknowledge that is definitely the way that people often respond to the argument, and there is something deeply felt about rights. But I'll say a couple of things. One is that, of course, rights can't be absolute and existential for everyone, because we're all different from each other. We have different commitments and values, and they come into conflict, right? And so rights that are in conflict with one another can't both be absolute and existential. But this view, which we do, I think, associate with Americanness and often tied to the founding, is relatively new. And I date it in the book to roughly the 1960s, when courts and also politicians and people outside of courts are responding to a bunch of kind of very new rights claims in the 1960s around the sexual revolution, around the women's rights movement, around criminal procedure, lots of new free speech rights. And we be sort of deluged by this avalanche of rights claims. Courts get a lot of anxiety about them and decide that they have to pick and choose which rights count and which rights don't. And I think that's where the path that we're on now basically starts. The founders took rights very seriously. And so the idea that rights are really important does date back to the founders. But the founders did not think about rights in this quasi-absolute sense. And they certainly didn't think about rights as something that judges are supposed to decide for us. They thought about rights in very much political terms, as something that political communities are devised in order to protect. Mm. And we've really gotten away from that vision.
So just to be clear then, are you asserting that you think the modern understanding, layperson's understanding of what constitutes a right in the United States is, to borrow the title of your book, is that, do we have it wrong?
I think we certainly have it wrong when it comes to actually resolving disputes, especially resolving disputes through the law, right? You and I can think about our rights in our homes, in our kitchens, in our places of worship, and in our families, and think of them as inviolable and absolute, and that's totally fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But once you get to the law, actually bringing the violence of the state to bear upon our dispute, right? We might disagree with each other about which rights we have. That process of legalizing rights, I think, has to, if we are to live together as a society, has to think about rights in a different way, in a way that in the book I refer to as mediation, rather than thinking about rights in existential terms. The law can't think of them that way, even if we as American citizens do.
Okay. You are asking for a very, I would argue, a challenging form of compromise in the United States right now. But if you could just stand by for a second, Professor Green, I want to turn to Jack Beatty. He's On Point News analyst, and he's with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, hello there.
Hello, Magda, and hello, Professor Green.
So give us your take of what Professor Green is laying out here in saying that that really sort of how we conceive of rights and how the United States since the 60s has looked to the courts to sort of confer or protect rights is led the nation down the wrong path.
Well, I want to – this is a big and various and rich book. But I just wanted to focus on one part of it, one strand here. The Black Lives Movement has drawn attention to structural racial inequality, the tragic burden that centuries of white over black have imposed on present social arrangements. An example of structural inequality in Boston – this is from a Federal Reserve study. The median net worth of white families, $250,000. The median net worth of black families, $8. Structural inequality. Another example, in Washington, D.C., a black child born there today has a shorter life expectancy than a child born in India. Another example, de facto segregated schools about which no one does anything. They exist. In fact, James Baldwin quipped that de facto segregation means that Negroes are segregated, but nobody did it. These are all examples of structural racial inequality built into our system. The way to demonstrate it exists is through statistics, is through citing disparities, as I have. And yet the court has slammed its door against recognizing the disparate impact of laws and social arrangements. Why is that, Professor? And why is that a huge barrier to justice?
Jack, by saying it's a big book, and that's a big question. And it's a big question that I touch on in a number of places in the book. There's a couple of ways in which the court, as you say, slams its door on recognition of structural inequality. One is that it never recognizes it directly. And there's a series of cases in the 1970s involving so-called disparate impact. So when there's a claim of discrimination that is not specifically intentional, but there's a differential impact on people of a certain race, the court doesn't recognize those claims at all. There's also an important case in the 70s around schooling, or a number of important cases around schooling, but there's one in particular about whether kids in poor neighborhoods have a right to equal funding with kids in rich neighborhoods, even in the same school district. And the court says no, and race and structural inequality is very much bound up with that case. The other way is even when the state tries to recognize structural inequality in various ways, the court kind of shuts its door to that. And the affirmative action cases are a good example of that, where the reason why lots of institutions pursue race-based affirmative action is to combat structural inequality, but the courts don't even recognize that as a valid reason. The reasons why are complicated. They're political. They're ideological. But one of the really important obstacles to recognizing structural inequality is that if you think about rights as being absolute, it's going to be really hard to say you've got an absolute right to never face structural inequality, because that's going to require courts to really change society in ways they're not comfortable with.
Mm. Well, Jamal Green joins us today. He's a professor of law at Columbia Law School. His new book is How Rights Went Wrong: Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst, is also with us. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking with Jamal Green. He is a professor of law at Columbia University, and he's out with a fascinating new book called How Rights Went Wrong: Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. And we're talking about things like free speech rights, religious rights, gun rights, privacy rights, civil rights. Jamal Green says our focus on defining those rights and having the U.S. court system be the one that defines and defends those rights, in a sense, is turning America's politics and all of us as Americans into fundamentalists. Jack Beattie is also with us as well. He's On Point's news analyst. And Professor Green, I wanted to pick up a little bit with your historical analysis of, again, in your words, how rights went wrong. And you mentioned this deluge of rights-based cases that came to the courts in the 1960s. But a little earlier than that, there was, of course, famously Brown v. Board. And I'm wondering if you think Brown v. Board falls in this same category, or that for some reason, Thurgood Marshall arguing against separate but equal, the only path was through the courts.
Well, I think Brown is, of course, rightly decided, and courts were an essential component, not certainly by far from the only component, but an important component of the struggle against racial segregation. An important point about Brown, which is it's a central case in the book, as it is in American constitutional law, is there's a couple of different ways of thinking about that case, right? We can think that case is about rights in the sense that there's a thing in the Constitution called the Equal Protection Clause. And because there's a thing called the Equal Protection Clause, and because the right way to understand that clause is to ban racial segregation, that therefore the students, the black students in Brown, had to win. And that's kind of the narrative we often tell about the case. A different way to think about the case, though, is that it's not about the definition of the Equal Protection Clause. Right, that's very legalistic, right? It's about oppression. It's about abuse. It's about terrorism. That case came out the right way because one segment of the population was terrorizing the rest of the population. That's something that is important for courts to recognize in a rights dispute, rather than kind of taking all the blood out of the case and saying this is about the meaning of a constitutional provision. And I think that's, in a lot of ways, emblematic of what we do today. As you look at a dispute, and rather than think about the facts, rather than think about who's benefited and burdened, rather than thinking about why the government's doing what it's doing, we reduce it to, oh, this is speech, or oh, this is guns, or oh, this is equality, and then legalize it so that lawyers shift papers around in order to figure out our disputes, when these are fundamentally political disputes that should be resolved in the language of politics.
Okay, but rights also, as conceived in the United States, I would say they exist, and I'll just borrow language from a reviewer of your book here in The New Yorker, who said that rights exist to protect minorities, and so therefore those same minorities consider themselves as besieged by the threatening many. I mean, and I actually think the Brown case is a perfect example of that, because African-American children were indeed besieged by the white majority in not having access to an equal education. And so therefore, what I still am trying to understand, like, what is it about how we conceive of rights that you think makes the courts particularly poorly suited as the place to decide what those rights are and whose rights are protected?
So let me first. This is a nice intervention. Let me first reject the premise,
okay, right, okay.
which is that rights exist to protect minorities. Rights exist to protect everyone, including minorities, but not just minorities. In Brown, if blacks had been the majority of the population, the case would still have been rightly decided. It's not because they're minorities, because they were oppressed, right? And so the minority majority distinction, I think, doesn't map onto rights very well. Rights are what we form communities to protect, right? So when we pass a law, when we pass a gun safety measure, right, that's to protect the security of the population. People have a right to security, and they secure that right through a gun law. People who have guns and want to keep them also have rights to keep their guns, right? But then those rights come into conflict. They have to be resolved in some way. But the idea that you just assign rights to one side and not the other is, I think, wrong. It's not to say that courts have no role to play. It's to say that politics also has a role to play, and those have to be reconciled in some way. And the way to do that is to use the language of politics as well as the language of law, which is about evidence. It's about, in a dispute over rights, the kinds of questions we should be asking is, why is the government doing this? What are the alternatives available to the government? What is the nature of the burden on the person who's affected by it? Are there ways of alleviating that burden that would not prevent the government from achieving its objectives? If so, it should do that. Right? Those kinds of questions, rather than saying, well, who has the right? Because rights are everywhere. They're in the laws that we pass, and they're also in the objections to the laws that we pass. And so we've got to get past the kind of facile language of, well, what's this right? And get to brass tacks, which is really about mediation.
Okay. So let me just drive straight at something here. In your doubt that the courts, particularly the federal courts and the Supreme Court that sits atop them all, that these are the right places for the kind of mediation that you're talking about, I should say the correct places for the kind of mediation you're talking about, part of that emerges from, as I believe you've written about, your concern that these are unelected judges, right? They're nominated and appointed through a different process here. I'm wondering how what you're arguing differs from what we've been hearing from conservatives for at least a generation, who also looked to the courts and said, we should not be deciding these major American issues with, you know, in their language, activist judges, and instead do so through legislation. I mean, I feel like you're arguing almost exactly the same thing, which in my, to my ear for at least the past 25 years has been a conservative argument.
So I don't think that judges should not be involved in these cases. I think judges are have been an extremely important part of our tradition. And the job of a judge is to recognize situations in which the core values underlying the Constitution are triggered and try to resolve disputes that raise those tricks. So it's not to say judges shouldn't be involved, not to say that judges should not recognize rights claims, but they also have to be attentive to the rights embedded in the law, right? So it's not to say that they have no role to play, or that you're an activist judge if you, you know, insert yourself into a rights dispute. Judges are important. Judges are important in recognizing oppression. Judges are important in setting the bounds for our politics. So if you take a case, so, you know, the conservative assault on so-called activist judges over a certain period of time, they're not, they don't feel that way when it comes to gun control, for example. But the conservative assault on activist judges that followed Roe versus Wade, for example, right? There's one way of looking at a case about abortion rights and saying there is no such thing as a right to abortion, which is the typical conservative argument. The argument I'm pushing is not to say there's no such thing as a right to abortion, but to say, of course, there is a right to abortion. But there's also laws that are passed, and we have to figure out, are these passed for reasons that we understand to be legitimate within our tradition? Do they go too far? What's the evidence that they're going to achieve the objectives that they're trying to achieve? Right, those kinds of questions, which get past the question of is there a right to abortion or not. I don't think that question is a difficult one. I think there is.
Jack, do you want to add your two cents on this? What do you think?
Well, you use an example there when you're talking about Roe, a counterexample of Germany. That Germany had a controversy even before ours, and in some ways as virulent as ours, over abortion rights. They worked it out in a very different way, and you call it mediation as between rights, as opposed to saying you have rights, woman and fetus, you don't. The Germans found a way to not divide the baby. And what was that role, and how did that happen? And then what do you say to this? A few years ago, Justice Breyer, I believe it was, alluded to foreign, may have been German, some other jurisprudence to show, you know, here's how this law or this decision fits in with international precedent. And the hue and cry from conservatives, oh, my God, he's looking abroad for models. The point is, you propose this model in the way Germany dealt with abortion issues. And I'm just saying that I want to hear about that. But also, what about the way this just gets rejected out of hand by conservatives? You can't look abroad.
Well, the book does look abroad, so guilty as charged there. And if you just reject an argument solely because it's also something that happens abroad, then the book is not going to be that appealing to you. But the German case is so fascinating because the issue is approached from a kind of opposite direction, where in the U.S. in Roe versus Wade, there are abortion restrictions that are being struck down because they're not sufficiently protective of women's autonomy. There's an abortion liberalization law that is struck down because it's not sufficiently protective of fetal rights. Now, from an American perspective, that looks stunningly conservative, right? And conservatives would, I think, dance in the streets at the idea that you can strike down an abortion liberalization because it doesn't protect the value of fetal life. But importantly, in Germany, where it was very controversial in the early 1970s, the court said, well, no, the state has to pursue multiple values at the same time, right? The state has to pursue the value of fetal life, and it also has to pursue women's autonomy and protect it. So the question is, how do you do those at the same time? And what ends up happening, and it's a long story that I tell in chapter five of the book, but what ends up happening is a kind of compromise politics around social protections for women that enable them to make choices with a support network in place. So prenatal care, postnatal care, child care protections, employment guarantees, the kinds of things that make it more likely that someone will choose not to terminate a pregnancy. That protects life and also protects choices, right? So I'm not suggesting, and I don't suggest in the book, that this option is necessarily available to us in the U.S. today, given how far we've come on the abortion issue. But it is to say that there is a space, and there was a space, for courts to bring sides of a political controversy together and to force politics around something that people had very different views about and find some overlap, which is really what politics and living in a society is about.
Does that not happen here in the United States, at least even in small ways? Because there are occasional cases, let's say, that make it all the way to the Supreme Court, where the justices try to narrowly tailor their rulings, their decisions, and they intimate sometimes in those very rulings that really the issue is one for Congress or state legislatures to decide, and they sort of in the manner that they can, they kick it back to lawmakers. So do we not have at least sort of the hint of a similar process here?
I think we do, and I think that there are some instincts in that direction. I don't think that courts should be narrow just for the sake of being narrow. I think they should be narrow when there are interests that the political branches are asserting that the courts should appropriately be recognizing, right? So if the political branches, going back to Jack's earlier example, have decided that they want to pursue structural inequality, right, by having a race-conscious policy, right, that is an instance in which it makes some sense to give some space to the legislature to do that. If the legislature is acting in ways that are transparently oppressive in Brown versus Board of Education, for example, I don't think that's an instance in which narrowness is necessarily appropriate. But I do think having some conversation with, being in dialogue with other institutions that should also be charged with thinking about our collective life in constitutional terms, those are political institutions, is appropriate for courts, right? They should be engaged in those conversations. It is not the case that the court is the only sole and exclusive guardian of our constitutional rights. That's a terribly destructive way and polarizing way to think about rights conflict.
Mm. Well, so you what you write about in the book is that your deep concern is that this approach of turning to the courts to solve rights conflicts has rendered our view of what rights are as this constant battle where basic freedoms are endlessly at stake. And I think one of the reasons why is because, you know, when you just mentioned that there are cases in which transparently oppressive actions do need to be resolved in the court, well, that what is transparently oppressive is oftentimes in the eye of the beholder. I mean, let's just listen to Wayne LaPierre of the National Rifle Association talking about the Second Amendment back in 2013.
It's not just words on parchment. It's not some frivolous suggestion from our founding fathers to be interpreted by whim. It lies at the heart of what this country was founded upon. Our founding fathers knew that without the Second Amendment and that freedom, all of our freedoms could be in jeopardy. Our individual liberty is the very essence of America.
It's Wayne LaPierre in 2013. So, Jamal Green, I mean, again, that issue of things being transparently oppressive, well, as we all well know, the NRA looks at any gun laws, any kind of mediation over the ownership of weapons in the United States. In their view, even the slightest idea is to them transparently oppressive. So what do we do about that?
Well, there's not much one can do about people who have extreme views. Now, judges are human beings, right? The law requires people to exercise their judgment. And so if a Wayne LaPierre were to get onto the Supreme Court and have to make get a Second Amendment case, I'm confident that he's going to rule for the gun owner in either event. What I'm suggesting is that the reason he should have to assert is that there's no other side to this, right? The gun safety measure has no legitimate purpose. Rather than hiding behind a kind of formalism or textualism about the Second Amendment, we should have those conversations openly rather than hiding behind legalisms.
Well, Jamal Green, stand by for a second. His new book is How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst, is also with us. More when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about the future of electric vehicles because there are more and more of them on the road every day, and a major turning point might be just around the corner. For example, General Motors says it's going to produce only electric vehicles by 2035. Volvo says it will sell only electric vehicles 5 years earlier, by 2030. And now there is an all-electric version of the Ford F-150, America's best-selling truck. So are you an electric vehicle owner? Are you preparing for the future of entire fleets being EV? And if you're not sold on electric vehicles yet, what is giving you pause? So dealers, city planners, what are you waiting for? How are you adapting to what might be an all-electric future? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are having a fascinating conversation with Professor Jamal Green. He's a professor of law at Columbia University, and he's out with a new book titled How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. And in the book, he argues that America's approach to adjudicating the question of rights and how to protect them and doing so largely through the court system is polarizing American politics. It's paralyzing us and, in a sense, turning us all into what he calls rights fundamentalists. Jack Beattie joins us today as well. He's On Point's news analyst. Now, Professor Green and Jack, if you could just listen along with me, because we wanted to get a better understanding of why contemporary advocates are still frequently turning to the courts on these issues of rights. And so we spoke with ACLU civil rights lawyer Chase Strangio. Now, last year, Strangio argued before the Supreme Court on behalf of Amy Stevens, a transgender woman who had been fired from her job as a funeral home director. The Supreme Court decided in Stevens' favor, ruling that discrimination against transgender workers is a form of unlawful bias on the basis of sex. Now, Chase Strangio is currently suing Arkansas over that state's ban on gender-affirming treatment for transgender youth. And Strangio outlined to us the constitutional arguments he's making in the case.
One being that there's a right to equal treatment under the Equal Protection Clause. You're treating cisgender people different than transgender people. And then an argument that the parents have a right to, direct the care and upbringing of their children. Also that there's a free speech right, a right to speak and then to hear information or to receive information, I should say, under the First Amendment that is also being infringed by the prohibition on even referring So doctors are prohibited from referring for certain treatments.
So we're going to hear more from Chase Strangio in just a moment. But Professor Green, let me turn back to you. First of all, what do you make of the fact that part of Strangio's argument is pointing to rights that aren't necessarily strictly enumerated in the Constitution?
Well, I think that's I'm not sure I agree. The Constitution states rights in very broad terms. So we have equality rights. We have right to due process. Freedom of speech is not an especially specific right when you think about all the different ways in which one can speak. That's part of the core of the argument in my book, which is that if we had a constitution that thought about rights and laid out rights in extremely specific terms, then it would make sense to be extremely specific in the way that we recognize them. But our constitution tends to lay out rights in quite broad terms. And so I don't think any of the rights that Chase Strangio mentioned are not constitutional rights because they're not specifically laid out in the Constitution. There are almost no rights that are specific in the Constitution. We have a very broadly framed Constitution, and so it leads lawyers to appropriately assert rights in constitutional terms.
But of course, in your book, though, you argue that courts are reluctant to go so far as to listen to those arguments and then clearly affirm that those are new rights, for example. There's a deep reluctance to do that in the federal judiciary.
I think courts are willing to take creative rights and recognize them sometimes, but not all the time. And I think it's fairly arbitrary when they do and when they don't. Courts are afraid of rights that they feel like they can't discipline in some way. And so social and economic rights or disparate impact rights, rights that that if recognized absolutely would force them to change society in radical ways, they get scared of those rights, but not because they're not in the Constitution or are. I could give you a host of rights that that courts recognize that aren't specifically in the, we don't have a right, there's no constitutional right. We talked about abortion rights earlier. There's no constitutional right against the government requiring you to have an abortion. That's not specific in the Constitution, but I guarantee you that just about anyone would say that right is there, because the rights that we have are stated in quite broad terms that prevent the government from oppressing us in various ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's turn back to why Chase Strangio continues to look to the courts regarding the rights of transgender Americans. I mean, as we well know, this year, state legislatures nationwide have introduced more than 100 bills directed at limiting the rights of the trans community. And so, I mean, seeking a political solution, this is the direction that many state legislatures are going in terms of rights restriction. So given that, Strangio told us that activists have little choice but to turn to the courts.
When you are encountering relentless assaults on people's survival opportunities to still have one tool in the toolbox, being the demand to go to the government and saying these individuals have rights under the Constitution, under federal civil rights statutes, as one way to push back on that encroachment of state violence. And, I don't think we're in a position to eliminate that when there's just so many relentless assaults.
So what should be done in cases like this, Professor Green? Because I'm thinking of the trans community. I'm thinking of the fact that it was state legislatures that passed all the Jim Crow laws. We also from decades past, we now have state legislatures passing laws and governors signing bills to restrict voting rights. So if you're advocating for a political conversation, for political mediation in a broader, more sort of vibrant discussion of rights, can we rely on the current political process in the United States to produce that?
Well, perhaps not. The book is not, and I don't think the courthouse door should be closed or that people should not go to court to assert their rights, right? The book is not about whether courts should be involved. I, in fact, think courts should be involved in more disputes than they're involved in today. What it's about is what happens when people get there. What do courts say? How do they evaluate those claims? And those claims have to be evaluated at retail rather than at wholesale. What do I mean by that? When we think about rights for people in the trans community, it's not enough to say, there's a right that anytime trans rights are at issue, the people asserting those rights have to win or have to lose. We have to see what the law is. What are we talking about? What kind of law we're talking? What is the way in which the oppression claimed is manifest? Right. We have to see what's actually happening in the case, rather than simply saying, well, the Constitution gives a right to any particular community, or doesn't give a right to any particular community. It just depends on what the law is. And so, a law that says that that prevents a transgendered person from being employed oppresses them in very serious ways. We need to know why that law was passed and what justifies it in order to resolve the case, of course. But a different case might be quite different, right? I'd want to know the evidence for any claim about medical procedures relating to people who get surgery. If it were the case that those surgeries were in fact terribly harmful to people in ways that could be documented, well, that's relevant to the case. So it's not to say that I think we can't resolve these sorts of things in the abstract. They're not just cases about rights, because communities also have rights to pass laws. They're cases about cases. They're cases mm-hmm. about disputes, right, in which there are values and important commitments on both sides often.
Yeah. Well, Chase Strangio told us one more thing, that he does see a potential for change in the rights-based legal model, if we can put it that way, especially when so little legislation currently, in Chase's view, is being passed by government that fully so little legislation is being passed that further protects trans individuals.
We need to change the courts. We need to change potentially even the Constitution, because it's very limiting in many ways. But I guess I'm hopeful that we will continue to be creative and make new demands. You know, we can say, oh, we want the government to pass laws, not just demanding equality of treatment, but demanding specific affirmative things for housing, for food, for comfort. You know, we don't have rights to those things.
That's Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Transgender Justice at the ACLU's LGBT and HIV Project. I mean, Professor Green, just comment on that for a second, because I think an area of agreement here is that the focus on defining and protecting rights through the courts has led it to be far more difficult in the United States to come up with laws, with policies, as Chase says, that honor affirmative rights, healthcare, food, shelter. Has it made it more difficult to do that in the U.S.?
Absolutely, it's made it more difficult, and this is something I focus on in chapter 4 of the book. Is if we think about rights in almost absolute ways, rights to housing or rights to healthcare or rights to education are going to seem very foreign and threatening. The idea that a court is going to come in and order the government to provide equal health care to everyone seems oppressive, and it is, because courts shouldn't be involved in that kind of politics, right? So if that's how we think about rights, we're going to say, well, there must not be a right to health care, or must not be a right to education, there must not be a right to housing. But if we think about rights as an invitation to mediation, then we can actually ask the kinds of questions that are important to justice. So if someone is being denied an education for no good reason, or denied an equal education for no good reason, as in the San Antonio schools case in the 1970s, where poor people, kids in poor neighborhoods, just got manifestly worse schools than kids in rich neighborhoods, well, then courts should have an entry point into that kind of policy. But if we think about if we think that the only way courts can have an entry point is if they give, you know, perfect equality to everyone, then they're not going to do that, right? So the book is about protecting rights. It's about protecting those rights that courts are afraid of by forcing or trying to get people to recognize the ways in which rights populate all sides of disputes, and so then require a much finer approach than the kind of what I think is a pretty blunt approach by courts.
Yeah. So this is really critical here, because you are imagining a world where through policymaking that lawmakers could actually be effective and creative even in coming up with systems of governance and a civil society in which all kinds of rights and fairnesses are addressed. But I think the problem is people don't have faith in the political system as it is. I mean, for example, we got a listener here who sent us this message saying, Americans seem to think that individual rights are a la carte menu items. What we need is a functioning Congress that defines our collective rights through a sound political process. And I would add to that, Professor Green, that you are also by pointing a finger at the downside or the dangers of the zero-sum game approach that rights adjudication in the courts brings about, and the fundamentalism, essentially, that has brought about, and saying we need to move at least partially away from that and towards this more creative lawmaking, you're also asking people to be willing to be to compromise more, to accept compromises across the political spectrum, and even the slightest compromises that they might find unacceptable. I mean, is that even possible today? That very fundamentalism that has been formed through looking to the courts has infected our politics outside of the courts.
Well, I think that's right. I'll say a couple of things. So one is that if courts approach rights conflicts as if compromise is not necessary, then that affects politics, right? So if courts were to say, you know, we're not going to give you everything you want, then that affects the amount of leverage people have in political conversation. It affects what people ask for from courts, right? So these things are related to each other. I'm not utopian, right? So I don't think that the political system is what people want from it. It has lots of problems, but I also think it's important that to recognize that when I say politics, I don't just mean Congress, right? Mm-hmm. Or I don't just mean a state legislature. There are lots of sites of politics. In fact, we're having one right now, right? So conversations that happen within the media, conversations that happen in a youth sports league, conversations that happen in people's living rooms and in their places of worship and in their civic organizations. These are all places in which the political culture is formed. That's where we work out what our norms are. And those then inform our political choices and what the political universe looks like. Mm-hmm. And if we think courts are the place to do that, then that's going to be hollowed out. And that's not a very healthy society.
Yeah. Well, Jack, we've got about 30 seconds left here, a little less than that. I'm going to give you a final word today on this really fascinating thesis from Professor Green.
Well, I think you make a capital point, Meghna, that the stark win-lose binary decisions made in courts have infected the polity. it's as if, and especially the controversy around abortion and abortion rights is an example of that. That's been no help in terms of our general political temperature. And the professor suggests ways of perhaps dialing back that polarization.
Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst, thank you as always. And Jamal Green, author of How Rights Went Wrong and professor of law at Columbia, thank you as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.